Lifter.
Right.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Hello. Right. Welcome to everybody. Lovely turnout. I'm Vanessa Senger from Grow Sheffield, one of the members of Grow Sheffield. Grow Sheffield co-hosting with Sheffield Cuba Solidarity Campaign as this leg of Roberto's UK tour. Okay, so thank you much for coming. One of the things we will need to keep an eye on this evening is the temperature in this room. So if anybody starts fainting, please put their hand up and we'll get them to put the air conditioning on. Okay? Right, okay. In a minute, I shall ask some people to say a few words about their organisation. But first of all, I'm sorry, I've got to attend to a few boring domestics. One thing is the fire regulations. If there's a fire, nasty loud noise, fire exits there, and where's the other one? Out there, through there, okay? All pile out, right? But please, if we get some latecomers, please don't allow them to put any chairs by that fire exit. Okay, that's important. There were refreshments upstairs, but we don't have any permission to have food or drink in here, so please be a bit careful about that. Timing, we're going straight through now to about 9:20. There will not be an interval, but you know where the loos are if you need to leave them. They're just through there. But we do need to be promptly out of here at about 9:25. So that's the timing, that's the domestics. Apart from a plea for anybody who hasn't paid, who will be paying for the talk, for their entrance here, please be sure you do that before you leave. And also, if you are coming to Cubana, we will have to ask you for a contribution of £5 for the tapas buffet that we are supplying. So if you haven't done that, please see Jerry or Diane or myself to pay. Okay, boring bits over with. Okay. So to introductions, first of all, just briefly, Roberto, our star speaker. Gillian, who is a Green Party councillor and also chair of the council's allotments advisory group. We also have Steve Ludlam, who is chair of the Sheffield Cuba Solidarity Campaign. And my colleagues from Grow Sheffield, Stephen Watts and Alice, who will also be involving themselves later on in the discussion. So over to Gillian to say a few words and also to start the introductions in more detail. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. It falls to me to formally welcome Roberto from the city, I suppose, the city council, because I'm a councillor, but from Sheffield as a whole, welcome. I just want to say I find this incredibly exciting personally. I saw the film. Last autumn, Grow Sheffield put it on as part of their abundance project, and I just thought, wow, that is amazing. I remember just being bowled over. And then a few months later, the Green Party had a contact from the Cuba Solidarity Campaign saying that they wanted to show this film and bring Roberto over, and could we do it as a joint project? And we said, yeah, that sounds absolutely great, and then it didn't happen for some reason. So for this to pop up again now is just wonderful for me. The film and the project sort of brings together, I guess, everything I believe about politics, that it should be oil-free and community-based and people-friendly, and everything that I love in my personal life, which is about gardening, and just bringing those things together is wonderful. And as a mark of my thanks and pleasure at being here, I've got a little present. I may get a chance to give them later. This is for Roberto. It's an apple from my allotment.
Thank you.
And it's called Fortune. The name of this apple is Fortune.
Yeah, so variety.
The variety is
good.
Fortune.
Fortuna.
And I've also got a present for Vanessa, and I always wondered why a tomato was called Vanessa, but this variety
is
Vanessa.
Oh.
And these are for you, Vanessa.
Oh,
I'm afraid I haven't brought any vegetables with me at all.
thank you very much for coming to this meeting, which we're very happy to co-host and to welcome Roberto on behalf of the Solidarity Campaign. I won't attempt to say anything about Cuban agriculture because that's what Roberto is going to talk about, but I will make two associated points. The Solidarity Campaign exists for one principal purpose, and that is to end the illegal blockade of Cuba by the United States, which has been going on now for half a century almost, and has enormous impact on its agriculture, but on its whole society, not its whole economy, and to support Cuba's struggle for self-determination. And I just want to mention two things very quickly which you might be interested in. We've got a stall out there so you can pick up leaflets. First of all, one of the actions that's been part of the 50 years of military, diplomatic, and sometimes terrorist attacks on Cuba, most of the terrorist attacks from Miami, has been the introduction of plant and animal diseases by agents into Cuba. And this is not a secret, this has come out in court cases. At the moment, there are languishing in US jails five Cuban agents who were sent to Miami, in effect, to spy on the terrorist groups, but not to spy on the United States. But they were arrested and charged with conspiracy to spy on the United States. That campaign is now being supported, the campaign formed by the TUC and the biggest trade union. And I would urge you just to pick up one of these postcard things on the way out. Have a read of it, and if you agree with it, please send it. And secondly, within the last few weeks, Cuban agriculture has been devastated, as many of you will realise, by Hurricanes Gustav and Ike. And Vanessa's kindly agreed that at the end of the evening, a member of our group has recently been through the United States with the Solidarity Campaign and into Cuba yet again, is going to make an appeal on behalf of the Hurricane Recuperation Fund that, again, the unions are supporting. So thank you very much and welcome.
I'm just here to highlight what Grow Sheffield does as an organisation. Grow Sheffield has acted since last year as an umbrella organisation, trying to draw together all the various elements of kind of the green movement, you could almost say, which involves specifically around food, which is common to all, and the key elements to Grow Sheffield is that it wants to highlight the benefits of local food growing in terms of physical, mental health, in terms of registering carbon footprints, community building. Grow Sheffield has run a number of projects which are things to try and engage people in a creative and positive way, and specifically through informing people and giving people a means by which they can act and actually get involved in food growing. So the main things which we've been doing is we've been doing this project called the Abundance Project, which is a fruit harvesting project. We've been doing pruning projects, which is an extension of the Abundance Project. We've been doing preserving workshops. We've been trying to lobby the council regarding allotments. We've been looking at growing food in urban spaces, gap sites. We've been looking at allotments and the strategy and how you can get involved in allotments and just in general, just looking at urban food production as widely as possible. That's basically what Grow Sheffield does.
Well, I don't want to bore you talking too much from the very beginning. But I just want to say thanks for this opportunity. It's been a very hectic tour, and this is my 20th day in the country. But I will try to do my best with my sore voice. I just want to call the attention about one little point here. As you can see, say, how Cuba survived peak oil, Community Solution. Community Solution is a group based in the United States, in Ohio, I'm almost sure, that they're worried about the phenomena of peak oil. This will be a short-term version of the film that maybe some or many of you have seen, because it's the parts that are more relevant to Cuba. But basically, they were thinking about peak oil. I don't want to give you a long explanation about that, I think that most people more or less know about pig oil. Basically, in two sentences, no more cheap oil, and the demand of the like the society, the civilization, it's many, many times over the supply that can be provided by different sources. So the easy oil to get and the resources, they're gone. Some people say that happens in 1999, some people say that happened in 2004. But what we are going to see, it will be that it will be very difficult to get new resources, even when people are so obsessed to go with the Arctic Ocean, Alaska, different places. And there will be the ways to get more expensive as tar sands in Canada that nobody thought about exploit tar sands in Canada, in Alberta, until the petrol cost $70 per barrel. And they say, no, it's not possible. Okay, they're making a lot of money right now because the petrol costs $100, American dollars a barrel. So that's basically this. There are other considerations around that, but the idea, I personally consider that we're going to have, before peak oil, big problems with climate change, with agrofuels, with the price of food, but that's my point of view. I just wanted to call the attention to that because the version that you are going to see doesn't have that part that is in the full version of the film. And one more time, it's an American group. It's their picture of what they saw in Cuba. I personally agree, and I can tell you that those are true facts, no? But please don't think that this is a Cuban government propaganda or anything, because it was not the case. In fact, they wasn't allowed by the Cuban blockade laws in the States to hire an American crew to go to film to Cuba, nor to hire a Cuban crew to film in Cuba, which would be the cheapest. So they have to go to Toronto in Canada and hire a Canadian crew and travel with them to Cuba. Just to give you an idea like how this is the framework and all the things that you will see that we got have been with a lot of sacrifice and a lot of work by many people and the support of like the Solidarity people in Cuba. Just that. Thanks.
Just a word then about the rest of the schedule. The agenda has sort of been planned right at the last minute. We're aware that a lot of people have actually seen the full version of Power of the Community, the film. For those of you who haven't seen it, then Transition Towns are showing it three times, and we've got some leaflets here to show you where you can see it. So what we're doing is the first item on the agenda is a 20-minute summary, an extract from that film made by Real News. Then Roberto is going to take over and going to do a shortened version of his presentation so that we can then have lots of time for questions and answers, but not just for Roberto. We're trying to take the pressure off him. I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions for him to start with, but then a few of us up here will make up a bit of a panel so that we might be able to get a discussion going. Okay? So we're going straight through, as I said, with no interval. So that's the schedule. We will turn the lights down in a minute and start the film, all right? If somebody could, Mark, could you, in a minute, when I tell you to turn, because I've got to find the...
It's number seven, I think.
It's number
you
seven.
Press seven.
And I've also got to turn the volume up, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
The breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s created a major economic crisis in Cuba known as the Special Period.
So we have, from 1989 to 1992, 1993, a free fall of the economy of 34% of GDP, gross domestic product. When I tell you free fall of the economy, trying to imagine an airplane suddenly lose their engines. It was really a crash.
Cuba lost 80% of its export and import markets. Oil imports dropped by more than half. Buses stopped running, factories closed. Electricity blackouts were common, and food was scarce. People almost starved.
In reality, when this all began, it was a necessity. People had to start cultivating vegetables wherever they could.
Over the next decade, Cuba took drastic steps to find solutions. It is the first country to face the crisis that we will all face, the peak oil crisis.
Easy. 2 years ago, we learned about a concept called peak oil, in which we will find that oil production is sort of reaching a peak sometime in the next few years and will be going down, and that implies basically a major change in our way of life.
After the Soviet Union, oil import dropped from 13, 14 million tons a year to only 4. Cuba in the 80s had 90,000 Russian tractors, factories of pesticides or chemical fertilizers we received from the Soviet Union. In 1990, everything changed. An American dollar reached 150 pesos. And the average salary is like 2 pesos. No? There were people that were making $2 a month. So money was not useful to get stuff. So we end up being like an experiment, no? Like with controlled conditions. Like nothing or very little things can get from the outside. So everything has to happen from the inside.
Every aspect of Cuban life was affected by the special period, but no change was as far-reaching as agriculture. Cuba had committed to the Green Revolution, a system which requires the massive use of fossil fuels in the form of natural gas-based fertilizers, oil-based pesticides, and diesel fuel for tractors and other farm machinery. The country's agriculture was more industrialized than any other Latin American country and exceeded the U.S. in its use of fertilizer.
The Cuban agricultural conventional Green Revolution system never was able to feed the people. It had high yields, but it was a lot oriented to the plantation agriculture, open economy. We export citrus, tobacco, sugarcane, and we import the basic things, 55% of the rice, more than 50% of the vegetable oil, of the oil and the lard that we consume. So the system, even in the good times, how people here remember, never fulfilled the basic needs.
Cuba's agriculture began to falter as one problem after another halted production. Fuel and parts for tractors were almost impossible to find. Seeds, tools, animal feed, and vaccines were scarce.
Esto trajo como consecuencia que el de estar aquí era una prácticamente una agricultura de supervivencia y los insumos que había de químicos ya no existían. Por ello que se dejó de la harina de trigo, los fertilizantes, los granos, el aceite, fue un golpe muy fuerte y muchas personas pensaban que el proceso podía colapsar en 3 meses o 6 meses. Y realmente fue una etapa muy difícil para readaptar la economía a las nuevas condiciones. The lack of fuel drove us to have a very big shortage of food.
So people, they end up squatting places in the city and growing food there. Without knowing how, because there were engineers, there were doctors, there was not farmers.
A drastic effort to convert every piece of arable land to organic agriculture was begun. During the special period, Cuba was able to help prevent famine through an urban agricultural movement.
Every vacant lot in the city was turned into orchard.
At first, urban gardening was an ad hoc local survival response to the crisis.
And when they needed food, they didn't know how, and they just did it, trial and error. And there wasn't space, they have a problem with garbage, dumping, rats, so they fixed all of those problems, get rid of the garbage and start growing things there.
Another thing during the special period was the identification of idle plots of land, right, that were cleaned up by the community and turned into agricultural gardens, urban agricultural gardens.
The neighbors are starting to see the possibilities of what they can do in their spaces, and they're starting to create natural gardens on their roofs and also in their patios.
Cubans, who formerly lived on the equivalent of just $2 a month, found new ways to supplement their income.
These grapevines have a lot of uses. It provides shade, so you have a little patio area. You also can make wine out of the grapes, and it's very good for the family economy, because if you do it well, you can get about 10 pesos for a bottle of wine.
Cubans' view of agriculture has changed dramatically. Farmers are now among the highest paid workers, and people from all fields are attracted to the profession.
The farmers in Cuba are not the poorest people in the society. On the contrary, they have food, so they don't have to spend their money on food, and they sell food, so they make good living. No? So it is important to take that in account, that it's another way to dignify the people that grow food.
With a very low cost, we were producing food, and now we have more than 1,000 kiosks allocated in the city that provide you with fresh fruits and vegetables produced in the neighborhood.
More than 50% of the total vegetable needs of the Havana's population, 2.2 million inhabitants, is supplied by the urban agriculture.
In small cities and towns, urban gardens are even more productive, providing 80 to 100% of the fruits and vegetables they need. Urban agriculture supplies food locally, eliminating much of the need for transporting food over long distances.
The country has 169 municipalities. So 5 kilometers around the municipal towns also are considered urban agriculture. So it's a national system that is employing more than 140,000 people, actually. It's creating jobs. It's a growing sector of the economy, and it is very important. And we're very proud to say that.
Cuba eliminated the need for natural gas-based fertilizers and oil-based pesticides by developing organic farming methods. Fortunately, research centers had begun studying sustainable agriculture before the crisis. Because of this preparation, the transition to an approach to farming that didn't depend on fossil fuels was implemented nationally within just a few years.
Bueno, el problema, uno de los problemas que trae la tierra con químico es la mineralización y la desaparición de la microflora y la microfauna. La desaparición de la microflora, de la vida del suelo.
Cuba found that it took from 3 to 5 years to make the land fertile and productive again. Cuba's new agriculture uses a variety of soil-enhancing alternatives to rebuild and maintain the soil. Crop rotation, composting, and green manure, which is a process of plowing young vegetation into the soil. Many tons of organic compost are produced, using kitchen scraps, rice hulls, and other organic matter. Worm humus is made in long troughs, where worms are fed organic waste products. This makes a richer fertilizer than regular compost.
Una tonelada de humo lombrí equivale a 6 de materia orgánica.
Today, 80% of Cuba's agricultural production is organic.
The lack of fuel drove us to use less machinery, to go to smaller farms, to combine different crops in one small piece of land, preventing pests spreading.
In the 80s, in Cuba, we used 21,000 tons of pesticides, chemical pesticides. Now, it's 1,000.
Cuba uses crop interplanting to reduce the need for pesticides and make their agriculture more sustainable.
Nobody fertilizes a forest, and nobody irrigates a forest. The forest do by itself. So if you are able to create like something like a food forest, your main effort is like pick the fruits and pick the products. And so in that way, the effort is less. You work hard in the very beginning, but once the system is established, you work a lot less. It's what we call lazy people agriculture, but it's because you are working with nature, not against nature. These people in the conventional system work against the nature.
Arriba!
One of the good sides of the crisis was to go back to oxen, to use animals. Not only that they save fuel, they do not compact the soil the way the tractor does. They exert less pressure, and even the legs of the oxen remove the earth.
Older farmers who still remembered how to grow and train oxen were set up in training schools. In a little over a year, most cooperatives had someone trained, and the process of raising thousands of oxen had begun. To increase food production, the government worked with farmers to find local solutions. The result was smaller farms and cooperatives with a high degree of privatization and autonomy. 40% of the large state farms were divided into privately owned cooperatives. Tens of thousands of acres of land were leased rent-free to small farmers. Decision-making was localized with fewer state regulations.
Two requirements. You grow things there. If you don't grow things there, we take you the place away from you and give it to somebody else. And second, that the land is delivered to you in usufruct. Usufruct is an old Roman word that means that you can use the land without paying taxes or without paying for it. But if this land is needed for another purpose for a man, it can be like you have to give it back to the government.
These smaller farms and cooperatives were better able to use the new sustainable practices vital for growing food organically. Thousands of families moved to rural land. With land rights guaranteed, a sense of ownership led to greater productivity. Private farmers' markets and new export markets led to greater production.
The communities have changed. It's a local economy. People were exchanging. Many of these gardens, they supply for free food to elder people circles, daycare centers, schools, working centers, pregnant women. And they do it for free. And they don't do it because it's compulsory. They do it because they want it. They want to do their little part to the society. But in other places, people don't know their neighbors. They don't know their names. They don't say hello to each other. Here, no, the neighbor knocks the door and say, I need some salt. I need some sugar, whatever. I brought you an avocado. No? And recover this sense of neighbor. It, for me, it's not going backwards.
You maintain a
Without oil for transportation, Cuba's educational system was threatened. Decentralizing universities provided people with access to nearby schools for higher education and lessened the impact of fuel shortages.
For your information, Cuba had 3 universities, but today has about 50, 7 of them in Havana. At other countries, developed countries, everything goes around making the automobile more efficient. How much energy do you need to produce a car? You have to spend energy on producing a car, and later you have to find the fuel to make the car move. So think about reducing the number of cars.
During the worst of the crisis, there was very little fuel for cars. The freeway and country roads were almost empty. Cuba needed to develop a mass transit system overnight. With few resources, they had to be innovative. Old trucks were made into buses with canopies to keep off the rain and steps welded on the back. Another solution was the camel, a trailer pulled by a semi-tractor that can carry up to 300 people. In Havana and other provinces, carpooling and hitchhiking are common. Government cars are required to pick up anyone who needs a ride.
One day, people start thinking about the end of the car. There will be an era, a moment in the life. So one day, the car appeared, and one day, the car will disappear. The cow would be something that we will remember as a moment in the development of the mankind.
In Havana, if you don't live in one of the old single-family homes, it may mean living in a dilapidated building or with your relatives in a crowded apartment. Even so, the city is a place many people want to live. But living in a city without adequate transportation causes major difficulties. To reduce the long commutes, new mixed-use developments include schools, places to work, and places for recreation within walking and biking distance of people's homes.
Everybody must use the same space. So design provides a common space for everybody. This is a way to keep your community alive.
At the start of this special period, 95% of Cubans were connected to the national electric grid. The other 5% lived in remote areas. Photovoltaic and wind energy are too expensive to meet much of Cuba's energy needs. But for areas not connected to the grid, small-scale wind and hydro systems, as well as solar panels, are used. Priority is given to schools and clinics. They also began using crop waste to generate electricity.
Sugar mills have been turning into power plants because you mill the sugar and then you have the bagasse. You burn the fibers, you produce heat, and then you produce electricity. So you can turn a sugar mill during the season or after the season into an additional power plant. The problem is what the people said about Cuba in the States is not what we are doing here. Many people there think how they can survive if they don't have anything. Okay, come here and you can see how we can survive. And in this way we can begin to understand each other and to know how to think. Mankind is burning in one century all the oil accumulated by nature during millions of years. And that is absurd, completely absurd. I don't see that countries who depend largely on imported oil are thinking about alternative sources of energy. They are just planning for the next week.
So there are infinite small solutions. You fix one little problem here, one little problem there, and life is better. You think globally, you act locally. People have to start from scratch and start to do small things, baby steps.
I think we can learn a lot from each other and reflect more on how to be happy with less and how you really don't need that much, to be happy. I think that that's a challenge, a world challenge. Cuba has modest experience that, you know, maybe some other people could learn from. And I think it will be a time for sharing, a time for cooperation, and a time for more solidarity and for working together. I think maybe we'll have a better world.
Well, back here, and I don't want to repeat the information of the documentary. Just I would like to add a little bit of context on the like what was before that, and a little bit before as they're explaining, and some of like how this shaped what we call our agrarian culture. And I would be referring to try to clarify a little bit more some of the phenomena in regarding sustainable farming or agroecology or organic farming that happens in the rural parts of Cuba, and the forms of agriculture that we consider in the urban agricultural system. I'm talking a little bit, sharing with you a little bit some of the achievements that the permaculture movement that started in Cuba in October of 1993 have in this system that it was before. So I just reduced the presentation speech up for you in order to make it more interactive. This is a very typical a scene of Cuba. Of course, those cars broke a lot as well, but they're simple mechanics and people can fix it with a piece of wire or whatever, or they can manufacture the parts. But this, it's also a typical scene of Havana and many of the Cuban cities. And this is really, really what we have to do in order to face like the crisis that we have. This is the logo of the organization that I work, the Foundation for Nature and Humanity. Some context, very quickly, this is the Tropic of Cancer right here in the 23 degrees north latitude. Very low and narrow main island, another 1,000 of islots and keys here. From here to here, 1,300 kilometers. From here to here, 29 kilometers. Here is the only piece of land that is more than 60 kilometers to one of the coasts. And the population, surface, we are, in respecting the scale, we are also in an island or an archipelago and a little bit crowded there. Not as here, but and the influence of like the sea climate, the sea in our climates are also very, very big. And for any colonial countries, there are always an after and before the arrival of the Europeans. In our case, was Christopher Columbus, and this was the situation. Cuba was more or less like that. This is the highest waterfall of the Caribbean. The population was very low. And only the ones that they came in the last wave, Arawak Indians, that they're still some base in the delta of the Orinoco River, they did a very primitive form of agriculture, basing cassava and squash and beans. In our case, our evolution is more South America, not Central America, nor North America. The same for the nature. This is Amazonian type rainforest. And the West Indies Chronicles, they say that in Cuba you can walk for 1 week under the trees without seeing the sun. Just to give you an idea, like how the true discoverers of these islands, they were maybe in a primitive culture, but they were living in peace with the nature. And the yields of cassava grown in mounds in small slash and mourn into the forest were four times the yields of wheat by that time in Europe. It's the magical primary productivity of the tropics, okay? And so this is like the idea of what was before the Europeans arrived to Cuba. In 4 centuries of Spanish colonialism, these are the main features. when they came, they suddenly appropriate the big landlords, and with the money that they sack in Cuba, they buy nobility titles in Spain because they were like the sons and people that they didn't have the right to the land. And this, in the beginning, these smaller circles were used for cattle production because, like, the main thing in the very beginning was salt meat and leather and different things to supply the fleet, the Spanish fleet that got here. Around Havana, there was no agriculture because these were the forests of the king to supply all the spare parts for the boats. And the equivalent to the crown land would be only that they were for many years forests, the little spaces between the big circles. And we were promised by the Spanish after the independence of the South American colonies in 1814 that we would get the provincial status like Canary Islands. But they never, and we decided to stay with Spain. But they never accomplished, and they were sending to Cuba the most corrupt generals as governors to sack the country, to continue the illegal treaty of slave from Africa, and to finance their dirty wars all over in Europe and in many places. In 1868, a small group of people started the independence war. This process in three different wars, the first war lasts for 10 years, the second one lasts 3 years, and in the other one almost 4 years. When Spain was finally destroyed, the Americans intervened in the conflict in 1898. But this totally exterminated 25% of the population of Cuba, 1.6 million by that time, and totally destroyed the agriculture that it was very, very flourishing. But please understand that we were not a land of farmers. We were a land with a few landlords that owned slave plantations, and the rest of the people were agricultural working, and they were doing some other things. There were very, very little amount of farmers. The post-colonial republic, I prefer to call that because those people fought for 30 years, and at the end in 1902, the Americans had to leave the occupation. They left funny amendment in the Cuban constitution, and that's the origin of the Guantanamo Bay base, because they reserved this some space for some base, and they still have it there. And all of this model of plantation agriculture was expanded. There was a marginal production of food. Some of the Cantonese people that came to build the railroad, because we have railroad before in 1853, before Spain, because of the sugarcane expansion. These people, they grow some food. There was like a massive process of deforestation, and the concentration of the land in very, very few hands, it caused total misery in the Cuban countryside. We have to say, because it's fair to say, that all the way up to 1964, 1965, we didn't have conventional agriculture in the country. They have big enough plantations, cheap enough labor, not necessary to use chemicals and not many tractors and machinery that we were using. They were misusing people and animals and things like that, and they have great production. And this is very, very important, that they prefer to bring cheap labor from Dominican Republic, from Jamaica, from Haiti, because they could pay them in tokens, in pieces of metal that they can only use inside the farm of the owner. So they were a win-win solution. And so most of the Cubans, they were totally in a state of misery, and they couldn't find work. Only, not even cutting the sugarcane 3 months a year. But after 1939, the Spanish Civil War, there were some people, some groups, especially from the Canary Islands, from Galicia, from Asturias, that they came to Cuba and they started to grow food and to do some sort of like agriculture in more farmers' way. No? Only in the west part of Cuba, when there are the tobacco plantations, and in the center of the island, Las Villas, like in the rest of Cuba was very, very poor, and coast to coast property of 10 Cuban families and the American companies. Very symbolic is that, no? Remember another map here, 95%, the whole black map. Before the expansion of the sugarcane industry in Cuba, only 20% of the land have been cleared. You can see how little, and that's why exactly, like the Cubans could do the guerrilla work against the Spanish, because the Spanish only were safe in the cities, and it was impossible for them to go after the Cubans in the deep forest. So the nature was always helping the Cubans. When the Spanish left, in the big expansion of the sugarcane industry, that we were the main exporters of sugarcane for almost 200 years, a little bit more than half of the forests were left. And you can see what we inherit in 1959. Only 14% of forests. So what we inherit, it was a country when 86% of the native ecosystems were totally sacked and destroyed in terms of for this plantation agriculture that there was. It went directly to the banks of the Americans and the Spanish and a few rich Cubans. I think this is very, very important, because like the idea that it's a tropical country, a Garden of Eden, it doesn't match that well. No? Like, our main environmental problem is the land degradation right now. In 1965, okay, when the revolution came to power in 1959, the first law that it was approved, it was the first agrarian reform law. Some people think that the land was taken from people. False. The land was taken from the big landlord, latifundistas, and the big companies. And it was given to 200,000 Cuban families. In the second agrarian reform law in 1962, the maximum private size, the maximum size for the private property farm in Cuba was 56 acres, 27 hectares. And some of the people, they started to work in that way. But, as I mentioned to you, Cubans were not farmers. They were agricultural laborers. So, to be a farmer, maybe some of you are farmers, maybe. To be a farmer, it's a different process than to work in the countryside. You need to take risk. You need to make decisions. You need to be 24/7 dedicated to that. It's very different. So there was a process. Along with this, with the creation of better conditions in rural towns in Cuba, people gradually, some people delivered gave back the land to the government, and they preferred to work for the government as agricultural labor and enjoy all the benefits, all the things that were happening in the revolution, than to keep like farming in a private basis. This, along with the cooperativization, like a group of farmers, they gathered their lands and they became equal partners, ended up with the situation that the small farmers occupy 15% of the arable land of the country, and the CPAs of Cooperative for Agricultural Production in 1990 occupy another 10%. So 3/4 of the arable land of the country were government owned and government managed and government used, with this state-of-the-art conventional agriculture model. Typical 10 tons combined tractor to cut the sugarcane, the compaction of the soil, you can see. And 90,000 of these tractors, they make 2 kilometers on the liter of diesel. 6 factories of chemical fertilizers, 25,000 tons of pesticides. But this, with that money, we imported food. And this really destroyed 75% of the soil. I don't want to talk a lot about this, no? Because like I think that it was very well explained in the documentary, but this is the idea of the crisis to Cuba. The purchase capacity of the country was reduced, all the inputs for the agriculture, they were falling in a way that, like, the system could not continue. Our markets for export, because the markets is always work, like, in terms of quotas and influence, it was gone. I remember that with, like, the Russian Federation, no, we signed an agreement that it was 1 ton of oil per 1 ton of sugar. Even in those moments, in 1990, we were able to produce in the country, making a big desperate effort, a lot of people working in long hours in the fields and things like that. We produced 8.5 million tons of sugar, but they didn't have the petrol to exchange. And what was available was the world market price, 5 cents, miserable prices. And the market by that time was more controlled by Brazil and Australia. It was very, very difficult for us even to sell the sugar that we already have. So in 1989, we were using 13 million tons of fuel oil that they came straight from the Soviet Union. Sometimes even we were able, if we saved, to re-export some to Nicaragua and some other countries. By 1994, we were using 3.4 million of tons of fuel. This is super peak oil. Like this really, really affected the Cuba. And of course, they say, okay, this is a matter of time, you know, like they're going to starve and they're going to come begging. And they those two laws, after that, there are many laws that they really reinforce the blockade. And they call it embargo, but it's not like that, because all the American subsidiaries companies are banned to travel with Cuba. And if a British boat touch a Cuban port, it's banned to touch American port for 6 months the first time and 1 year the second time. And this is like the face of Cuba. Those years were so difficult that we didn't even have cameras to take photos. So many of the things that were filmed in the documentary, they were taken from some of the documentaries that they were filming in 96 and things like that. Or there are things that recreates that moment. For example, right now we don't have camels in Havana, but this was the only public transportation. 350 people just cramped there, like breathing on each other. But you can see three cycles and you can see old Russian style vehicles. They were two main processes, as in any situation. No? You have to change. You can change the laws in short term and the framework. You can try to get some investment, and that's midterm. And the third is education. But in every society, there are processes that needs to happen in the inner self, in the down, and from down to top, and some process that happens from top to down. These are the process that happens from top to down. The decisions that the Cuban government take. Some people say that we don't change, that we're stuck in time, that we are a bunch of communists and all of those things. But believe me, we have to change every day since 1991 to the day. We changed the constitution to allow private property. There were many processes of decentralization. We opened the country to tourism. The self-employment, like people that work for themselves and small business, rose to almost 20%, and before it was less than 1%. The redistribution of land, the farmers of market, and overall, we realized that even when people were ready to defend what they achieved, like maybe you must know, like the health and what we call the conquest of the revolution, the universal and free access to education and things like that. But the idea was like we were not a country. Our main weaknesses was that we didn't have any sort of food security. And this food sovereignty policy was started. You can see here some of the horse cars in the case of Havana, there are more for tourists, but in the many cities in the countryside, there are the taxis, there are the buses, especially in smaller towns, because there are only public transportation right now in the provincial capitals and in Havana, of course. So this was one thing that was happening in the superstructure, but of course people were I don't think it happened slowly. In a couple of years, people were responding very quickly and taking the ideas of the transition towards sustainability as a life strategy. People started to grow food and they took the places. People started to relocate around the houses. In Cuba, it's easier to change of work than to change of house. So here is vice versa. You find it. You find a good job and then you move. No, it's so all this process was totally a rearrangement of the society in order to use low energy, in order to respond community basis and collective in terms of sharing scarce resources. And this is exactly what happens from the grassroots to the top. In the case of the agriculture, it was something that I have to say started. Sorry. By people, and then the government was more or less organizing, helping, training. In terms of the redistribution of the land, since I tell you, 3/4 that was in the state hands, automatically in the third, what we consider the third agrarian reform, almost 70% of the total lands of the country were given to the basic units of cooperative production. Different type of cooperative. And that means that they were not... They are partners, but the status of the land is different. It's a different type of ownership. And as I explained in the documentary, and some people explained, the use of the fruit, the Roman term, that you can use the fruit of a place, and in more individual plots, this amount of land was delivered for tobacco, for coffee, the urban agriculture. And this, let me tell you this, because I think that there is... This is one of the main contributions that we were able to do, even in the middle of the worst economic crisis that we ever faced. There were this idea, the forestry farm. So they would create these farms of 13 hectares, and the people say, okay, you move there, we build a house for you, and we're going to pay you. When people were chopping trees to make charcoal to eat because there was no cooking fuel, we're going to pay you per standing trees. If you grow more trees, we're going to pay you more every 6 months. But anything that you can grow under the trees is yours. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people came back, especially to the countryside, and they established different areas. And I think that this is one of the main achievements, even for the environmental issues. Remember, it was possible not only to stop the deforestation trend, we were able to increase the forest coverage in 10%. Who gave us money for that? Nobody. IMF, zero. World Bank, nothing. We did it with our own effort. And even in the middle of this crisis, we were able to make our modest contribution of to have like more forests for a carbon sink. No clean development mechanism, nor market. Working hard by the people. Not many countries can show an increasing of their forests. Right now, every day, one the size of Mexico, of forest, disappear every day in this planet. Because it's not only about the emissions, it's about like the capacity of the Earth as a planet with their forest to capture that is decreasing every day. So we were able to do that in a desperate situation. So we were not only thinking of eating, we were thinking in the future. In terms of fertilization, that is the most important point of view when you are making the transition towards sustainable agriculture, and these are recent data, after the film in 2008, we produced more than 8 million tons of organic fertilizers per year for more or less 4 million hectares. So we can apply 2 tons of organic fertilizers per hectare. I know we need more, but that's a very, very important thing. We don't need natural gas-based chemicals, fertilizers. And this is like it's a huge production of worm casting. In terms of another sources, for example, the wastewater for the sugar cane in the sugar mill, in Cuba, they were always a big problem because they were dumping to the oceans and they were sources of pollution. Right now, it's a precious resource. Don't touch that. we redirect this water straight to irrigate and to fertilize the fields. And these are our tractors. 150,000 pair of oxen working in the Cuban field with the implements. So this animal traction involve also, like, in terms for transportation, we use horse, but we don't use horses to work in the field. It's a tradition in Cuba. It's a way, and we recover the tradition. The other main problem for sustainable agriculture is the pest control. And let me tell you that in the beginning, in the very first year, it was very sad to see how the bugs eat almost everything. Because the conventional agriculture tried to control. It's a chemical warfare against nature. You're trying to kill everyone, everything in the soil, and just to keep your little plants growing. And then when you change that model, you need to fight the pest in a different way. Some of the things that we did, this is a tobacco extract or the nicotine extract, we call it tabaquina, that we make those teas. Smoking kills people. Of course it kills bugs. But I think that the starting point was this one. When we have a national network or center to reproduce the enemies of the pests. So there are people, their work is to raise ladybugs, to raise wasps, to raise the enemies of the pests, and to release into the agro ecosystems. So in that way, you create a system of predators and prey, and you reestablish some of the natural point. These are with the biopreparations, BT, and some other forms that you don't have to eat Monsanto to make BT. You can make BT in a metal drum. And that's what we do. Low-tech biotech. Then we learn the interplanting, the crop rotations, the trap culture, the natural control. And this has enabled Cuba that we're right now using around 900 tons of poison. When you apply that to 5 million hectares, you get a balance of an agriculture that is 87% organic, free of chemicals. But an agriculture that is not using very little oil. And it's an agriculture that uses very little machinery. And of course, sooner or later, some of the awards came. This is the most important award for the Organic Agriculture International Organization. This is the Sustainable Livelihood Prize. This is one of the most important, at least the most important in the Western Hemisphere, organic agriculture or agroecology. This is the movement that is totally horizontal, campesino to campesino, but that you also bring people from Mexico, from Nicaragua, from different places, because we're humble. We say that we need to learn. If the Cuban agronomists, they were seated like you in a classroom, and a 78-year-old farmer were training, retraining them, recycling their mind, we can learn from any farmer in this planet. And sustainable agriculture is not alternative. It's not hippie. It's not marginal in Cuba. It's something that is teach in the university and polytechnics. Urban agriculture, these are very fresh numbers. This is the surface. This is the number of people involved. These are all people that they work and they make a big living of this system. So it's not subsistence anymore. This is the production of 2005 was the last decent year with no hurricanes. As you can see, there are not many young people involved. The explanation for that in the urban agriculture that I can give with that, it's like in the moment when everything started, the people that really know how to grow things were people that they were relatively old because they were coming from the countryside. But they also have time because they were retired. Or they were not making a lot of money and say, okay, this is okay, no? So this is a challenge for the future. And the more important thing is that we finally get the recognition of the urban planners that the agriculture is a first thing that needs to go into the cities, like garbage picking and city parks and things like that. That costs some blood in terms that the planners, they're terrified to ruralize the city, and that's their worst nightmare. The geographical outreach of the of the urban agriculture, 14 provinces, small country, many provinces. This is the fringe, 169 municipalities, Havana City, small, mid-sized towns, and small village, always an area. So all of that is considered urban agriculture. And these are like the forms, because the agriculture in Cuba, the urban agriculture is organized by the different type of like garden you have. The organoponicos came from the word hydroponic. It was the hydroponics in the city that were abandoned because we don't have the money for the nutrient solutions. And basically, all this substrate was retired and compost was put in there. And the plants, of course, they grew very well, and we decided that they were called organoponicos. And these are the main and the most important unity of production. The yields of this type of agriculture, fresh leaf vegetables in the city, is 18 kilograms per square meter per year. That's a lot, believe me. That's nuts. And this one is a popular of grassroots. We can get 9 kilograms, which is very, very high as well. Then there were this. In the beginning, the government plots, that means like in Cuba, lunch is supply at work. Very decent prices, decent lunch, 2 pence, 3 pence, more or less. But at that point when there was no food, so this land was allocated for factories and big working centers, and people would go there and work for 2 months to produce food for their co-workers. It was a very good idea that fixed the situation in that moment, but it was not a very efficient form of production. So many of these plots are gone. And then we have anything that is bigger than 1,000 square meter, what we call intensive gardens. Now this is different from the organoponicos. They get 7-8 kilos per square meter of effective growing area per year. And this is like the base for the community gardening in the country. This is when people, for example, the people of this building, all of them started in this place. But they didn't have individual allotments. They grow together, plant together, share together according to the number of hours or the time that they were using that. Or somebody spending, you know, sometimes in the worst years, people have to take care of the plot during the night and things like that. And right now, they're more concentrated, but this is this idea, no? It's like the big space. The parcel or the plots is anything among these sizes. They're smaller. And the difference, and that's the number in the country, the difference is that in this area it's not only vegetables, but what we call minor crops, trees, fruits, bananas, cassava, and different things. And this is more like family-based, a couple of people, 3 people. It's different, no? It can vary. But they can sell, and they can even butcher animals there. There's no problem with that. And then the last part that was added to the system, it was the more individual base, the patios or the home plots, that backyards, front gardens, rooftops, and you can see here that they are very small, but they have multiple purposes. It can be ornamental, it can be herbs. It can be some animals. And this is like the natural ground for permaculture. It's more designing, maximizing yields, using available things. Then some other more highly technified things came. Still low tech and low energy. Like shade houses to increase the vegetable season, seedlings to support the. Like, if you want to grow vegetables in Cuba, you go to one of these places and you buy 500 seedlings of lettuce. And for those that grow things know sometimes how difficult is the seedlings, so at least the people get that support. And any farm that was in the fringe of the city was considered peri-urban agricultural system. There were 2 periods. 1 period when it was basically subsistence, when people do what they can. And after 95, it's more for market consumption. It's a very flowering industry that produced, by 2006, more or less 60%, now it's almost 70% of the vegetable needs of the population of Havana and some other places. And these are some of the permaculture came to Cuba in 1993. Groups of Australians thought that it was a very good idea. This is a typical permaculture plot. These are the keyholes to get access to the corners. These are the pathways, ponds, a hair spider, the compost beans, the worm farm. We collect the rainwater, you know, simple processes that talk about sustainability. The first permaculture design certificate was done in Cuba in 1995. Some of the results is typical permaculture before and after. Those cassavas weigh probably 4 pounds each one, 7 months after this. These are some of the results in terms of people trained, the recognition in the national and research levels, the family of designers. After the Australians pull out, because like the John Howard government moved more the efforts to Southeast Asia and they didn't like Cuba, we did a second stage when we start to work more like with international cooperation agencies. And then like good things started to happen. After being isolated for long years, we start to interact with the rest of the permaculture community, including some teaching in these countries. And we also use the permaculture as a very strong tool for environmental education because it really involves all dimensions of sustainability. Some of the recent highlights, David Holmgren, the co-creator of the term permaculture, our first national convergence last year, the Cuban-Australian permaculture exchange, Robin Francis was the first woman trained in permaculture in 1979, Geoff Lutton, some people, I'm here, and we will host the Latin American Convergency in November. I don't want to talk about the Cuban model because we're breaking the model every day. I prefer to call Cuba that it's a social project. And the only way that we consider that it can happen is in human and sustainable basis. And I think that it's very, very coherent with permaculture because the ethics of permaculture is to take care of the land, to take care of the people, share fair. But these are some lessons that I think that they can work in any place. First, the access to land and to water and resources, in our case, was in that moment a lot more important than the ownership and the property. We were lucky that the Cuban government had that land. But in other places, there have been other formulas. Right now, you know, in Brazil is happening different types of agrarian reform. In Bolivia, in Venezuela, it's tricky, but in Zimbabwe there is something happening, difficult to understand. And the other thing is like the small scale intensive pattern was a lot more important in a low energy future or situation than to have like thousands and thousands of hectares. It doesn't work that way. People need to feel belonging to a place. Fair market, very, very important. As soon as we have the free market that we call the farmer's market in Cuba, anything, any form of production have to sell lower than that price. This is the top. And it's okay, it's fair for the people that want to show there, but if you produce something, you know that you have to be good enough to sell cheaper than them. And the urban agriculture produce organic food 20% cheaper. The process of local economy. When you don't have food and you don't have a network and such a fabric, you cannot open a real local flavor restaurants, or you cannot make a tasting thing, and you cannot organize all the process. Once we get this food, it was relatively easy to organize like different things in the country that really helped with local economy. People preserve the food that like they make jars, jams, and different things. And this was the base for different ideas. People that they sell wine and they make different things. And this really, really allow people to diversify their strategies for survival. Another important thing is that in Cuba, the science is on the service of the people. Nobody signs an agreement of confidentiality. Nobody is like thinking to make a to patent something. And one of the indicators of the good science in Cuba is how fast this will is applied nationally. The political will. Maybe there are other examples on the life of Cuba when, like, the government and the ideas have been a little bit rigid. But I think that the agriculture and the food production system is the best example of flexibility, of, like, encourage people. The Cuban government didn't have money to invest, but it made possible so that the decentralized corporation work. The idea that if there was a project, they say, okay, let's use it in the eastern province that are the less development. Let's put one extensionist per people's council, that is the local government, to deal with agriculture. Can you imagine that every borough of Sheffield, we have one extensionist for the allotments? Can you imagine that? We have that. And the idea was like a support, but not like a control. The policy was not taxing, was not give me the food, I'm going to distribute it. It's an spontaneous process that is more or less adjusting, but the government is putting the resources in terms of the access to the land and in terms of the organization of the process. Environmental concern, not only the trees. With the agriculture that is practiced in the city have to be organic. It's criminal to use chemicals next to our children. Simple as that. So we never forget the environmental concerns. It has to be an agriculture that is making peace with nature. It has to be environmentally friendly. And if it can fix problems like garbage accumulation, of the reuse of gray water, and things like that, better. And I think that this system has been really closing the gaps between the cities and the rural. We don't have system of community-supported agriculture and things like that, but we really have a correspondence between the rural agriculture that is producing very hard, a lot of food, and the people in the city that send doctors and teachers, and all of this system is working in the sense that when, like the Coyula, the architect in the documentary mentioned about the kiosks are not from like urban agriculture. The urban agriculture people sell in their plots. They have different. But those kiosks are from the rural, the cooperative. So the people that grow food, they gain the recognition, and they know that the responsibility is feed the people in the city. It's social, not to make money. And, of course, the diversity of food systems. We can grow, so we have animals, we have different types, size of property, we have co-ops, we have individual producers, we have, like, people that they rent some peas. And, like, the idea, it's like the more diverse systems, the more production you can get. And I know that I'm talking too much. I'm going to finish very quickly. Some of the challenges, because it's not perfect, we really need systems that hurricane-proof systems. We're working on it. But sometimes it's too much. When you have winds of 350 kilometers per hour sustained, there is no way. But resilient talks about an agriculture that can quickly recover from those disasters. We need more farmers. Now, that's true. Actually, right now, the Cuban government is giving land, and there are not as many people to take it. I think that this depends on the infrastructure, and there is no public transportation. People don't have cars and things like that. And they're a little bit afraid of losing what they have in the cities. Mm-hmm. But we really need more farmers. And it's a matter to engage, especially young people. This is another thing that is very important. The food is getting expensiver and expensiver. And this maybe can make some people in the government to think that if they introduce some chemicals, they will get high yields and they will save some money. This is an internal debate in Cuba. I think many people make me this question. No, when the embargo is lifted, everything will go back and things like that. I honestly don't think so, because we have enough time to enter in the head of people And it's not the same. Right now we have cheap oil and we use less than half of 1989. Okay, no cheap. It's very expensive for us. But $29 is a good price per barrel. So the idea is, and also, what about the tractors? What about the roads that need to be repaired? It's something that it costs a lot of money. It's not only about cheap things. These sugarcane, 75 sugar mills were dismantled. And right now, these people, sugarcane was grown there in for 5 or 6 generations, no rotation. These people, they only know about sugarcane. And right now, we need to transfer this, but this land is severely damaged, and we have some cultural problems. It's a challenge that we have to face. We have a Ministry of Sugar and a Ministry of Agriculture. This is like two different universes. The Ministry of Sugar have more kilometers of railroads than the Ministry of Transportation. So we are facing nobody. When the 75 sugar mills were closed, people were keep paying full salary and they were sent to school. Okay? So nobody was abandoned, but it's very hard to see how your livelihood is gone. So these people, they still feel on their hats that the chimney of the sugar mills is not smoking. I think that right here, some people from the steel factories here, or people from the coal mines, and they feel the same. So sometimes you need to also heal the mind. And it's a big thing. A little bit more market incentive, I think that can be, especially for the cattle production and the meat production, there's still the insufficient incentive for that. We're poor. We need a machete in Cuba will cost half of my monthly salary. $10. Then converted with pesos. Huh? And even a Chinese, not very good one. Huh? So the idea that we still need this, no? Sometimes the UVPC, the cooperative, the government tried to force them crops for export. And since they don't have the necessary materials, they fall into debt and things like that. And then with the 10% that they have for self-consumption, they sell in the market and they pay the debt. But, you know, they need more autonomy, in my opinion. I think that we're ready for a national organic certification system. Right now, how it works, I know that there are some imports of organic fruit juice here from Ciudad de Avila and in Canada, some places. So, but the people that are interested, they bring to Cuba the certifying person. They pay for that. Because in organic farming, that is these groups that they make money just certifying things. You know, sometimes it's hard, no? For poor people, it's hard to enter the organic market. It's very hard. But I think we're ready. Still, there are some people that they dream because they were important when the Soviet Union was there, and they dream maybe to go to China and buy 10,000 tractors and go back. You know, we need these people to retire. And, of course, we will welcome, sorry for the spelling, some independent research evaluation in order to, like, for example, do an environmental assessment of the agriculture. Can we grow food in avenue like Fifth Avenue in Cuba with so many cars? There's some problems with the quality of the food. How this impact the health? I think we're working on it, but we need a little bit more than that. I want to finish with these photos. You know, it's not porno or anything. The most important thing in a transition, in a shifting of paradigm, is the culture. And these examples explain two different ways to face a problem. Okay, we want to reproduce our stock, no? This person has knowledge about artificial insemination. But look at, he's using no very sterile procedure, no gloves, no nothing. But he knows to do that, and he preferred to face a problem with that. This other farmer preferred the old-fashioned method. It has worked, you know. Pigs have fun, believe me. But what I want to tell you with this is, like, both ways to face the problems are totally viable. You face a problem and you try to fix it with according to your cultural values or your knowledge. First lesson, don't push the culture. too much, because other white people don't listen to you. They will think that you're a hippie or you're crazy. Don't scare them. And the second is, like, try to be inclusive. We have to remain all our base of knowledge, but we rebuild the knowledge in a horizontal level. The farmers were, experienced farmers were as welcome as the PhDs in agronomy, as the permaculturalist people, as the people that they were doing something in China. And the same way that we learn Eastern medicine, that we learn herbal medicine, and we learn many things, it's not going backwards, it's going forward. We are in the transition towards sustainability. To conclusion, very, very simple. The Cuban case, some people say, no, how is now? What changed? On the contrary, the system has been perfecting itself and trying to work more smoothly. What started as a survival strategy has become in a flower industry. And it's 20 years exactly, 1988. So in 20 years, you can really change the mind of the people. But in 20 years, you can prove that this system works, that this system feeds 11 million people, that it's resilient. And of course, the permaculture also offers very, very practical solutions to this, but also it's very powerful in terms of education. And that's last, okay? And we are convinced of that. That a different world, a better world is possible, no? Like, but the idea is like we were the first people surprised when in 2007 WWF says that Cuba was the only country in the planet, country, no community, that has the minimum requirements for sustainable development. We say, what? We're poor, we have a lot of problems. And then when we check the article, they just use the ecological footprint of all countries according to Wikipedia data and United Nations, you know, simple, reliable things. And they set up a line of like what the ecosystem of Earth can sustain. 0.8 is an index. And Cuba was there, as many other countries. India was there, China was there. But then they put that against the Human Development Index. And it was an indexing. So it was like two things, and a little square here that is sustainable development. And all the rich countries were here. Very, very high index of human development, but totally destroying the planet. And the other people were here, reasonable using the, but a very poor index of human development. And Cuba was like right in the border of the requirements, but we were there. What this proof, and this is totally independent, that it's possible to achieve a dignified form of life with like free health, education, and things, using less money, less energy, less resources, and without exploiting people. We know that even when in 1990, we were very happy with all the things, and we were hit by the crisis. And many things that we did it because we have to do it by force, by necessity. Right now, it's different. We think that the only possible pathway for a society to meet the challenge, it has to be sustainability. And believe me, that makes us feel a little bit proud of it. And the other thing that we know is that it's perfectly possible. And we are doing every day, even if some people are very mad at us. Thanks a lot.
Generally about things that might be pertinent to Sheffield.
and I'll try and take the role of chair to just try and feel.
Do you want me to turn it up?
Yeah. No, that's a lovely backdrop.
Okay.
Yes. Could somebody, do you mind how to do it? We're going to turn the aircon off. It seems to be getting a bit cold. Yeah. So I sit in the middle, Steve. Okay.
Nothing will kill you.
Oh, right, okay. Is that okay for everyone?
Yeah.
Okay. Gentlemen here.
Okay, thank you for the talk this evening. Much obliged, thank you.
You're welcome.
A question, simple question. I'd like this, the abridged DVD, whatever you call it, to be shown in schools, colleges, universities, and particularly my council. I really would, because I'm sure it's the same everywhere. You can try to get on an allotment. What allotment? And if there is an allotment, there's a queue. And to get people interested into this, it has to be done at a level through the council, but also education. And thank you very much. Please, I'm sure there's lots and lots of other questions as well.
Yeah, I'm curious as to how one could change over the allotment way here or anywhere, where instead of everyone taking a lot of space to put up fences in between their allotments, which is a lot of wasted land, we ought to be, excuse me, the idea we ought to be working more cooperatively and not just going to our individual plot in the beginning, but maybe starting to work to combine them to create food, because
mm-hmm.
so much land is being wasted for fencing from another.
the rationale is a good question. I always, the rationale in Cuba, even in the beginning when there were some ceiling and things like that, everybody was working very hard for the perimeter. So why bother inside? And that was the idea. If there were a group of people that they were sharing together, that's unthinkable, you know?
Mm.
So, but like sometimes, you know, there are some values of the culture that are based on individuality, and that takes a lot of hard work. But at least today, I saw like little holes in the hedges where people can talk to each other. That's a beginning. But I think it's a very good idea.
Can I just mention that the reason that we do roads, unfortunately, is to keep some people out that cause damage. You know, they will trash an allotment, you know, talking about usually the youth. And that's why a lot of us put fences around our allotments. So it enables us to grow things, you know, not being vandalised.
Gillian, you wanted to respond to that?
Yeah, okay. A couple of points there. Showing to the City Council, I think that would be great. Next Wednesday, isn't it, Bernard? There's a monthly full council meeting that all the city councillors go to, and every third one is what they call a scrutiny council, where they have a presentation. We have a presentation on an interesting topic, and next Wednesday it's going to be the chief exec doing a presentation about how Sheffield is going to respond to the current economic crisis. And it would just be fantastic if, you know, before his presentation we could see this. But it would also be fantastic if, you know, some people could come to the public gallery and say, you know, why don't you think about this sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously it's very hard to express it in a few words or in the form of a question or a petition. But, you know, it is very helpful to have that very strong sort of public pressure that kind of helps us in the Green Party try and push those ideas forward. On the allotments, there are a couple of points there. I mean, there are big issues with allotments. I mean, I'm extremely excited that I'm now chair of the Allotments Advisory Group. And, you know, trying to push those ideas. I mean, there is a kind of bureaucratic problem about the way that allotments are not being turned over. I mean, you're thinking if it's not being used, somebody else takes it. It's obvious, isn't it? It's so simple. But it's just tied up in all this bureaucratic red tape. One thing that, again, would help is just a lot of people writing to the paper and making a huge fuss about this. I mean, mean, I'm not going to go into the details of what bureaucratic changes need to take place, but that this sort of massive media pressure that people want allotments and it's got to be sorted, and if necessary, some money needs to be put in. But I think the other thing to say about, oh, there's a bit about fences. So there's a very interesting point about fences. I'm on an allotment site in the middle of Broomhall which has no fences. And I absolutely value that, because it means we don't get vandalism, because you just walk by and you can see what's going on there. You know, nobody would dare to do anything, because half the people who work a plot there can actually literally overlook it. But the other thing is that we went on a tour of the allotment sites. The advisory group went on a tour a couple of months ago and looked at some sites that are pretty well derelict because they've not been passed on properly. But as we were driving back in this minibus, passing huge plots of free land, you know, just verges along these roads. And yes, we do need the kind of scientific evidence that it's safe to grow kinds of food, and what sorts of food are not going to be poisoned by the cars, although hopefully there won't be too many of them in the near future. But, you know, actually, the amazing thing about Grow Sheffield is that you're just kind of saying, okay, you know, allotments are there, but they're a problem, but just go for it, you know, just go for the other green spaces around you. Mm-hmm. So don't, you know, don't be stymied by that.
Just a quick question related to that. Was there any investigation done on the soil quality and contamination problems in Havana before this was undertaken?
Most of the way that we deal with that is that we don't do the classical digging that you do here. We built our soil on top. And if they, like, even there are many of those places, their own pavement, parking lots. You just make sure about the drainage, and you bring your soil in, and you don't have to worry about what is underneath. In places more complicated like Havana, because we don't have that many cars, as in New York, even like former like car places where they have like petroleum and things like that, they just put a thick liner, a rubber liner. It is perfectly feasible. And like our system of like early warning and poly health works very, very well. And we don't have any problems reported with that. We have been very careful with people that they cannot irrigate with rivers and streams that they have coliforms and things like that. But this is more about management and not about like pollution itself. You see, these people will get such a big fine that it will have to sink twice. Third time he does that, the plot is given to somebody else. Simple. But it's a good thing in some cases. Aren't you, even in Cuba, we don't use like our oil is the petrol is not unleaded and things like that. You have many, many things that can help you more than you think. The thing is, like, and I'm gonna be very honest here, we have been brainwashed about these hygienic rules about the food system. I was today in a place saying, no, I cannot milk my cows, I cannot make yogurt. But who brought my cows? Who brought the chicken contaminated with dioxin? The system that it says that it's super safe. It's not that safe. Mm. But the thing is that we are being told that that's the only way. So the system is designed, in my modest opinion, to displace the small players. Who can afford to have a perfectly amateur and things like that? But all of those things, think about that. I don't know a single person in Cuba allergic to peanuts. Maybe we have the African genes that, because peanuts are from that, but we don't have the big factories when everything has traces of peanuts. Everything. Of course, you know, like when you combine that with all the cosmetics and all the chemicals and all the things, something has to happen to your body. Mm. So we really need to think a lot of things and try to. I'm not talking about extreme things like people having pigs in an apartment. No? We have that, but we, you know, the government will go there and, you know, that's it. No? But without extremes, there are things that can happen. And right now, the way the system is designed, it doesn't let to happen. But in Cuba, people torture their animals all over the place. You don't see like a lot of, it's a hot country, and you don't see people selling like pork meat in the street and things like that. And I, you know, like in Cuba, it's like we have the dengue and we have all the campaigns watching that. And I haven't seen many, many problems. But here, Australia, the States, E. coli, the most terrible bacteria in the perfect sterilized food factories. How that can work? So I think that we need to be more humble, you know. The society worked for thousands of years without that many restrictions.
Yeah.
One of the things you say is that access to the land has been really important in making all of this possible. And to produce 70% of the population's food from the land means that's a heck of a lot of land. Could you I didn't quite understand what the system of ownership of land is. Would you say that it was necessary for the state to take ownership of the land in order to redistribute it? Because it seemed to be various different forms of ownership of land going on, from what you said.
I said that we were very lucky that the government had that land, that they didn't have to nationalize or expropriate or rent. And I have seen other forms, you know, the government, the municipality of Montreal bought a bunch of hectares to when they were in their little crisis, and they put it in the hands of the people. They were not alone in more collective gardens.
So the government was lucky to have the land.
We were lucky that our government had the property of the land.
Right.
But in that case, we have the private land, that is the private farmers that they received that land in 1959, or that they have it. When you can show papers, for example, there were people, they have a lot of land. And when they showed the papers that they officially, that their land was like reduced to 56 hectares. But some people would say, my brother, 56 hectares for my brother and mine. And they were able, the small players were able to keep the land. But all the land that have been redistributed after that is given in the term of usufruct. That means that in a city, for example, when you have a plot and so, like a building needs to be built, they will give you another plot, or there will be some kind of dealing with that. But the main requirement is that you produce food there. And in the rural areas, the government right now, we call it lifetime usufruct. That means that you cannot inherit that land. And I think it's a very good idea because most of the second generation, they're not farmers. When you have the ownership, you can think about funny things, develop the land, sell it, subdivide it. But when you have the use of the right to use the land, it's very different. We did a study even in the metropolitan part of Havana, it's one part around the Amandares River, with some people from one university, the University of McGill in Montreal, in Canada, exploring if people were willing to pay for the land. And they said that if the government will do something like you have here with allotments, huh? Able to fence them, to give them water, and some other things, they were willing to pay up to sometimes 3 minimum wage per month for the land. That means that if they're willing to pay that, they're making more.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't need the property for doing that. They just need the access to the resource. And in some of the urban agricultural programs that we have been working in Cuenca, in Ecuador, in Santiago de los Caballeros, in Dominican Republic, the municipality, what it does is that. They make an agreement. Or people that they have just pieces of land, parcels, for future development, but they don't have money or the market is losing. The market is losing here as well. They make an agreement with the municipality to use the land provisionally for urban agriculture for 5 years. That's one way. I know that the problem is here, that here, you know, there are people that have a lot of land and the land is costs a fortune, but there are ways, and I am not the one to tell you what to do because I don't know very well the society. Thank you.
You talked a bit about sustainability and about the hurricanes, and I was very interested. I'm a gardener for a long time now, professionally, and I just wondered if anything had ever been mentioned about genetically modified seeds yet. Are you producing all your own? Because you said you're looking at producing crops that suit your particular climate and situation. Has anybody ever mentioned
actually that? In the beginning there were a lot of like seeds that people were bringing to the country and things like that, but they were mostly hybrids. Very happy first year, the rest. So we learned that we really need to produce our own seed. Non-hybrid is possible, heritage seed. But please take in account that the seeds that the urban agriculture needs are not the seeds that are commercially provided. Because these commercially provided, they are designed for the conventional agriculture. All they're ripe at the same time. We don't want that in an urban plot. I want a few tomatoes every day. I don't want all tomatoes ripe in the same day. So the characteristics that they have been selecting for the industrial agriculture are not the seeds that we really need. And this is very important. So only the seeds evolving and safe in the plots allow that. Of course, we are totally disconnected of the this genetic modified madness, but we have imports, and we're worried about that, of genetically modified corn and soybean for food for animals. It's not like, because it's proven that, I don't think that the problem of GMO is about, so far, about health. It's about domination. They want to patent the genes because they want to own anything. Mm. Once you own the genes, they know the genes will spread, and they want to own life. It's more about intellectual property, and not even though there's some health concern and no crazy things. We will have super weeds. We will have this Terminator gene spread to anything. We have a lot of problems with that. And at the same time, it's the biggest lie. This so high-tech agriculture won't feed people in Africa. They can't afford to implement that. They cannot sustain. They cannot even pay the millions and millions that I pay with that. So it's a big lie about that. But the farmers always, they save the seed. Oh, nice corn. Let me plant it. And we are worried about that. Because it's impossible to tell a farmer, don't plant that seed, don't plant that seed. It will happen to you, what happened to Persis Meiser, that was accused by Monsanto. No? And so far, the position of the government, the Cuban government, is like, we need more research about it. It's a big debate in Cuba. I study biology. I have many of my friends that are in the biotech industry. They do different biotech, but it's a big debate. No? And I honestly don't think that the hope for our food, it's nor in the GM food, not in the so-called precision agriculture, that the chips and things like that, and nor in the conventional. I think those things are part of the past, but these people have a lot of money and a lot of interest, and they have still a lot of consumers, and it's very hard to get rid of them.
Yes, I'm one of the other green councillors, the three of us on the council. I actually went to agricultural college years ago after my master's certificate in agriculture, but 4 or 5 years was convener of the Green Party's national working group on agriculture and food, so I'm very well versed on all this sort of stuff and very interested in sort of forestry farming. But you know, I must reinforce what Gillian says. You know, we want you to write letters to the papers, because we can put the most radical ideas, sensible ideas to council, but they will dismiss them because they feel they've got no support on it there. You know, we have a similar issue with asylum seekers in the city. We would like to put the most radical ideas into the council, and the councillors themselves would like to embrace those, but they just feel that public opinion isn't there yet. And I just feel that you've got to create that culture that you talked about, by writing to the papers, you know, pushing the ideas all the time. Because, you know, I would be quite happy in the next year to put a motion to council about how we should start the council. The council needs to start planning for, you know, for food production to tackle the issue of, well, food poverty in the city, which is going to hit us very, very soon.
Mm.
You know, we need to start thinking about these things now. You know, a year's time is going to be too late. So we need people like you to begin to think through how we can adapt what we've seen here to Sheffield and our particular problems. So, you know, please, you know, contribute to this debate and, you know, throw ideas in. Please do.
It's funny that you feel I wanted to ask a question, but you put the hand up. But I do want to ask a question, and it kind of ties
just grew his question.
It ties in with what you were saying, it's kind of two questions in one. Firstly, to put it in context, I've refused to use the flush toilet for 3 years. And most people would think I'm mad.
I can't tell, actually.
So the first part of the question is how Cuba deals with human waste and what's their approach to it? Because most people in the West have this kind of fear strategy of don't want to deal with that, let's flush it away. But it's not obviously permaculture. And then linked in with this is the idea of education. And actually, do you think people are actually going to adopt a Cuban model until it's absolutely necessary, or will they adopt it with an actual awareness that we don't need to wait till it becomes a necessity?
Okay, two different questions. I'm going to start with the last one. No?
Mm-hmm.
Humans spread in this planet because they were very flexible. They adapted. They changed. And they created a lot of life. The good biotech, they selected it. And they create thousands of varieties of different plants that they were adapted to different climates. Some people talk about biodiversity, but some people, they don't know about agrodiversity. And agrodiversity means that maybe we eat a few species, but the numbers of varieties and breeds of that species is very big. What is happening right now is that we were so spoiled in the last 40 years for the cheap oil and the madness, that we don't want to change. We don't want to adapt. And then the planet is changing, and we are stockpiling. This is not adapting. We're thinking that some people would think that they buy their self out of the problem. There's nowhere to go. And some people think that technology will bring something. I prefer to think that some other societies learn from what happened to Cuba for other reasons, and they don't wait until the moment the things became very hard for several reasons. Most societies, they are not as community-based as Cuba, and they will react very violently. In Argentina, they attack the supermarkets, they destroy everything, and the reactions can be very, very, very. There are riots for food in 14 countries right now. And the other thing is happening is that it would be a pity, because we have the energy. We still have some energy. We have the knowledge. And we have the time to prepare people for a different way to do that. And I'm not talking that the string case. That I'm not saying that everybody have to do what we did. But I'm talking that something can be done right now that will make the transition slower. In terms of the waste, we were for many years very Western country, you know, and there are only 5 compost toilets in the country. We built it. We have to really strongly fight with the people of the public health organization, and we have to promise them that we will use forestry trees, not invest. That's okay, fair enough. We have all good compass. But you know how we won the fight? When we told them that each of these composts can save up to 15,000 liters of water per person per year. And they say, because we have a problem with the water. We can have 400 millimeters of rain in 3 hours, like with a hurricane, or 4 years of drought between 2004 and 2007, like, you know, the cattle dies. So the idea is that we need to be flexible. We need to sell our ideas, otherwise, and I mean sell it, not for a price, sell it to make it sexy, like the pigs practice. And right now it's growing, but also the most important thing, it's like we are trying to work on national system for water treatment, for black waters, you know, the constructed wetlands and things like that, when we can integrate other production. Once that you clean that water, you can have tilapias, you can have all or other different types of production in a way that using the capacity of the nature to process that. And in that way, we don't force the culture to make people, oh, we're eating our own excrement. In fact, let me tell you that I don't know if some people know that one of the problems or one of the things that really led to the rapid expansion of chemical agriculture was during the post-war in Germany. They tried to use human waste. And of course, they got coliforms and infections and they were away. But the Chinese have been doing for thousands of years. But the Chinese fried everything. They cooked the food. So we need to think very carefully how we live and how we can adapt all of those things. If we push too hard, nobody listens to us. And you became like crazy people, simple like that. But still, we need a lot to learn.
Well, first of all, it was to correct an impression, I think, that Jenny gave, that 70% of Cuba's food was produced...
Vegetables.
Yeah. Because 70% of Cuba's food overall still has to be imported.
That's
the figure that I've get from Cuban economists.
Yeah.
Rough, 65-70%, but it's very, very expensive, and it's getting more and more expensive, and hence the government's redistribution of more land and use it for an attempt to concentrate that around the cities for low transport costs and so on. At the same time, I've read that the recovery of the oil refinery at Cienfuegos is likely to have a fertilizer plant built alongside it. And with world food prices rising and with the government having a big job really to get regular supplies of fruit and vegetable and food to people beyond the ration in the market. Could you say a little bit more about the debate that's going on now about the dilemma this creates for the organic agricultural movement in Cuba?
Very fair. I think that one of the problems is, like, in the case of Cuba, we are strangers in a strange land, in the sense that we our population was formed by migrant groups, and we don't eat, our diet is based on rice, and rice is the diet of people Southeast Asia. So we are like an island with totally different things, and we cannot produce wheat, and we love bread, and we love pasta, and we love a lot of things. So this characteristic of the diet makes that food have to be imported because it cannot be produced in the country for climatic reasons, or if we insist at the potato crops, we will have to use chemicals and go back to the same position because it's a cold country crop. You know, like if you want to grow in a world that is becoming hotter, you will have to use the things that we don't want to use. The other thing is, like, still we have another 3 million hectares that they are not used for to produce food. And they are used to produce sugar cane the cattle industry is occupying another 2 million hectares that is not producing, we don't need beef and things like that. I think it's a problem of reorganization of the systems and the idea of changing a little bit of the culture. If we want to drink beer, we have to import the barley and the hops. It doesn't grow in Cuba. And I personally think that, for example, for the government, because we have a ration card, it's a food basket, the government food production system, they are still now so inefficient that they have to end up importing that, because this is guaranteed to £1 per month to all Cubans. And this is like something that the government has a commitment with the Cuban population. But all the pork meat that we is produced in the country, if we produce double, we're going to eat it. If we produce more bananas, we're going to eat it. So the idea is the challenge of how to do that and how to convert more land and how to engage more people, how we are able to have more farmers. Because still, there are only less than 30% of the population is involved in the agriculture in the rural areas. I think that even from my permaculture point of view, we won't be able to produce more than 70% of the food. But the thing is, like, if there are restrictions on that, we will have the problems. The debate on the on these chemicals is big. The thing is, like, we, and there are many things that they think that the chemicals is part of the past. And we will lose 20 beautiful years of this organic system. I don't think that this will happen on the places that they are already competitive. And I think that we will need to enter in the certification system. But the beautiful thing is that we'll be reinforcing the dependence on another external source of that. The refinery of Cienfuegos is working for the Caribbean. Because we don't use much of that oil. In fact, I was in the refinery. They have to empty the tanks in the refinery of the Bay of Havana because all the storage capacities of Cienfuegos were more for the Petrocaribe, not for Cuba. No? And so some of these chemical factories, they were doing the other end. They were making the other end instead of all of those things. And I know that the country wants to recover that. But I don't think it's the way to go. And I honestly think that if we have a few more years, we will be end up exporting those things. We are not very happy. It's a big thing. In fact, in our organization, we're going to call for a round table. It's called SOS Sustainable Agriculture. But that's the reality. You know, we knew that the worst of the crisis won't last forever. Mm-hmm. And at some point we need to face that. Mm-hmm. We had 18 years to prove that this type of agriculture can feed the people. And of course, you know, like the problem with the hurricanes and things like that, it makes that people will always have to see, to think, to eat other things. And Cubans still spend 80% of their income, that's not the salary for. Because he said that these food baskets of the government, we don't have subsidized for the production. We are not paying a lot of money to our farmers to produce whatever. So our system depends more on efficiency and in the market. It's a very complex perspective, but I honestly think that this will be a waste of time, of money, and we will destroy more land.
When George Bush refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol, he said that climate change didn't exist. And then later they changed their position to say that they could innovate around it. But countries that have social systems like that just can't do it. It's the people that pull the strings in the government. It's not in their interest. They're going to be the last people affected by climate devastation. And the companies that would deliver this, the big corporations, can't implement systems like this, because this can only be done by mass participation, and they couldn't make profit from it. It is Cuba's social system that is the reason that such a system can be implemented. I'd like to compare this to another country that's close to my heart, Venezuela. They have a problem that, due to the dependence on a single resource in that country, the agricultural system was completely neglected until about 10 years ago, when Hugo Chavez came to power, and he's been moving towards making the economy more balanced, making Venezuela more self-sufficient in food. I think kind of these kind of social movements are the only way we're going to move towards a greener world before we're forced by the economic factors such as running out of oil, etc., and until it's too late.
It's not a question, no, but I think I'm sure that some social systems can be more prone to do the transition. Mm-hmm. But believe me, we all have to do that. I know it's hard. I know that there are many things, many obstacles, no? Because like what we have towards energy is an addiction. And even when people talk about green cities, they think in big high-tech buildings full of glass and not in bring more natural elements to do that. But the truth is that in the present situation, we all have to do that. And I think, and I don't want to paint like a creepy thing, you know, there is one circumstance that a group of people of a group of countries, very small, they were using and they are using the quotas or the rights to pollute, to make emissions, and to the use of energy of the other 6.2 billion people. And that's deeply unfair. And there is no moral deterrent to tell people in China right now that you cannot have a car. We can, but you cannot. So we are in a situation that the planet cannot sustain what is happening. But we have new players in the frenzy. We have 500 million rich people in China that they want beef every day and cars. We have 300 rich people in India. We have 200 million rich people in Brazil. We have 100 rich people in Russia. That's another billion wanting to enter the party. And the party is over. Yeah. The party is over. It's unfortunate that we never get 1 second in the party, but it's not our fault, you know. So sometimes I think that every society has to think very carefully about that. And there are changes that have to happen in the inner self. There are changes that have to happen in the grassroots. There are changes that have to happen in the governments. And somebody have to tell these people that it's time to make less money. But the idea is like the society is diverse, and we need to find diversity of solutions. And it's very difficult. Like, we were lucky we did a revolution in 1959, but how is happening now? The people's movements are the ones that are taking over, you know, and every solution has to deal with environmental issues. I think that two things that are happening here are very, very important, and I really think that it will be very important for councils to embrace. One is Transition Towns Network. Mm-hmm. Transition Towns Network started in the small town of Totnes. I met Rob Hopkins. These ideas can really, really work. They can play the same role that play LA 21, the local agenda 21 after 1992. Some people can say, okay, the environment is worse, the world is worse. But I can say also that thanks to that, the environmental agenda right now is part of every council or municipality or local government in the country. And the awareness among people is more than ever. So there are always like upsides of everything. Huh? I think it's a matter of critical mass, you know. And I know that in some cases I am preaching the converted, it's the people interested in those topics. But I think that when I give these talks, you know, in different places, it's not only about the Cuba solidarity, it's not only about the people of the left, it's not only about the people of the permaculture. So people are coming together and they see their face. That's the very beginning. I cannot be fatalistic. It's very hard. It's not education. I cannot educate people with Al Gore documentary. But you can educate people with the power of community.
Mm.
Last but not the least, I promise to be very short.
I am actually going to round it up now because I know that John wants to say something about what we mentioned earlier on.
Sorry.
And we want to round it up and say thank you, and we do need to start moving on. So I know there's lots of questions still out there. If you come into Cubana to be with Roberto and others later on, then you may be able to ask your questions also then. So, but thanks for us just for a moment. So John, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. My name's John. Some of you know me because for years I've been a Cuba solidarity activist in Sheffield. I now largely live in the United States. I want to say something about the hurricanes. Because 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, I was in Cuba leading a group of US citizens. We visited a small place called Puerto Esperanza, a little fishing village in the west of Cuba. It was a wonderful visit because we weren't being bussed here, there and everywhere to see projects. We spent 3 days in the village. So we'd go to the elderly person's home and they'd give us some fruit to eat. And then we'd walk down the road to the kind of farming cooperative that Roberto's been talking about, where they produce the fruit.
Mm.
And then we went to the fishing co-op and we went to see young people doing a dance performance. It was an amazing visit, very moving. 6 weeks later, Puerto Esperanza was largely flattened by hurricanes and Gustavo.
Mm.
2 weeks later, it was flattened again by Hurricane Ike. Hurricane Gustavo was a kind of normal hurricane, the kind that Cuba is used to dealing with every other year. It did a lot of damage in maybe 5-7% of the country. Hurricane Ike was not a normal hurricane. It came 10 days later.
Mm.
It went through Cuba from east to west. Somehow it managed to steer a course that missed Havana, missed most of the provincial capitals, not all, but it devastated rural Cuba. What does that mean? It means that 30% of the crops in the ground at that moment were destroyed. Cuba will survive for the reasons Roberto has talked about, because of the kind of government it's got, because of the kind of community it has. People are organising now to repair, rebuild, replant. But in the short term, it's going to be extremely hard. The Cuban government has to replace, in the short term, all those crops by importing food, and that's expensive. They reckon that the two hurricanes between them did $5 billion worth of damage. The Cuban import bill for a year is $8 billion. Pretty massive amount of damage. And then there was the housing. 60,000 houses or so flattened. Another 400,000 houses damaged. Mainly that means their roofs ripped up. That's something like 20% of Cuba's housing stock damaged. That is enormous.
Mm.
They're repairing them, they've started already, but they need the materials. They need to get materials imported from abroad, and that's expensive. And the cheapest place they could get them quickly would be the United States. And of course, the Cuban government has approached the US government and said, never mind the rest of the blockade, just make an exception. Sell us these roofing materials now. Of course, we know the answer. No, they will not.
Mm.
So this is an enormous economic setback from Cuba, which it will recover from in the medium to long term. But in the short term, it's suffering. Cuban people are suffering from those hurricanes. There's a worldwide campaign, many groups around the world that are raising money. We can't raise $5 billion, but we're going to raise what we can around the world to play our part in solidarity with the Cuban people. There's a fund in the UK from the Cuba Solidarity Campaign. So I don't know your name, but the box is there. We'll be sitting outside as you leave. You pay to get in, to pay for the cost of this pay for the cost of this event and his travel. I'd like as many of you as possible to pay to get out to contribute to that bill. Cash, checks, it's all fine. Thank you.
So it remains for me to, I think, say thank you very much to Stephen and Steve and Alice and Gillian for being up here and helping with some of the questions. I'm sorry about not having enough time for all the questions, but in the say there will be some later on.
I talked too much.
No, we should have you for another few hours. However, obviously, yet again, we must say thank you very much to Roberto for his energy and his passion and his humour and for a fantastic talk. And I had a lovely day, yes, driving around in the sunshine to various community groups in Sheffield. So once again, thank you very much, Roberto, for a lovely evening. And for those of you who are coming to Cubana, just to remind you, those who are not quite sure and haven't paid, I'm afraid it can't be free because they're going to charge us. So if you want some tapas, please see us on the way out. So, Roberto, thank you very much indeed. And